Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Got my mojo working, but Jeff's gonna work on you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to talk about exercise and how it can allow us to live a longer and more beneficial life to our body, minds, and especially if you get a little older, over the age of 40. We're also going to talk today about the omega-3 fatty acids, how when our children use them, they have less behavioral problems. So that's good for all those kids diagnosed with ADD and ADHD. A lot of men growing up as baby boomers believe that you had to have a lot of testosterone. Well, no. When it comes to testosterone, more is not always better. Explain why. Then orange juice could help improve brain function in elderly people. A lot of good research on orange juice. And antibiotic use in infancy disrupts your gut bacteria. That can create diseases later in life. And a lot more on health and healing. Then we're going to have a special commentary on the pathology of the rich white family, Truth Dig, Chris Hedges. Also today, we're going to look at who's Big Pharma's best allies on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Well, it turns out labor unions, wow, they support strong intellectual property provisions in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, so they're lining up right beside Big Pharma. Who would have thought? And I'll mention each one of the seven different unions that are now supporting the Trans-Pacific Partnership and how that will devastate America. Also today, we will have on David Crowe. David Crowe is an outstanding journalist. He has probably read more scientific journals on the subject of AIDS than anyone else I know of. And we're going to talk about some of the prevailing myths within the whole war on AIDS. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. This is from the University Hospital in France of Saint-Léon, and it says, quote, even exercise of short duration and low intensity has life expectancy benefits for the elderly. Such conclusions have been well examined in the general population, where a recommended exercise program of 30 minutes at least 5 days a week or 150 minutes a week has been shown to reduce the average risk of death by 30%. However, such a correlation between the level of physical activity and the risk of death has not been so clearly determined in the elderly. So they did this study, and they found out that they used 1,000 subjects in the French cohort study, and they found that those who exercised lived a longer life, even if everything else was the same. So if you're an elderly individual, make sure you're exercising, even going for a walk. Now, for everyone else, there's another really good research project that was published in the British Journal of Sports Medicine, and it shows that 30 minutes of physical activity 6 days a week is linked to a 40% lower risk of death. That's a big, big drop. I mean, just think about it. That's just with exercising. That does not include juicing, taking your supplements that are good to help prevent heart attacks and strokes and cancers and diabetes risk like chromium and coenzyme Q10 and vitamin C and quercetin and vitamin E and tocotrienols. So if you took your supplements and you de-stressed, and you ate a healthy vegan diet, and you exercised, then you would reduce your risk tremendously, add years on. This was a big study also, and it was a good study. There were 15,000 people in the study. So that's the deal. Exercise 30 minutes a day, 6 days a week, 40% lower risk of death. As you get older, you're protected. Now, we know we should be taking the omega-3 fatty acids. You can take them from fish oils, or you can take them from vegan sources, like flaxseed oil, and walnuts, and avocados. This is from the University of Pennsylvania. Quote, at the forefront of the field known as neurocriminology, a University of Pennsylvania researcher has long studied the interplay between biology and environment when it comes to antisocial and criminal behavior, with strong physiological evidence that disruption to the emotion-regulating parts of the brain can manifest in violent outbursts, impulsive decision-making, and other behavioral traits associated with crime. A new study now suggests that the omega-3 fatty acids, commonly found in fish oil, may have long-term neurodevelopmental effects that ultimately reduce antisocial and aggressive behavior in children. This was done at the Penn State Research, and it published in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry. So what's the takeaway message from this university study? It's simple. We all have seen or known some of the highly antisocial or aggressive or out-of-control children. And three things you do automatically, because you don't know off the bat why they're that way. They could be suffering from a form of vaccine injury to the brain that did not make them autistic, but affected adversely a part of the, let's say, a part of the brain that deals with emotional control. Or they may be taking a lot of sugar. Or they may have a brain allergy that manifests in antisocial aggressive behavior, like a dairy allergy that manifests in the brain. Some people get mucus. Other people get angry. But it also could be that they're deficient in the omega-3 fatty acids, in which case then try all of them. Put them on for 1 week, an anti-sugar diet, an anti-dairy diet. Take the cell phones away and then give them the omega-3 fatty acids, 1,000 units a day. So inexpensive, non-toxic, easy to do, and that way you can see what made the difference. University of California at Santa Barbara has a new study. When it comes to testosterone, the more you have, the worse it could become. For men in particular, the higher your testosterone, the more susceptible you are to benign prostatic hyperplasia or simply prostate enlargement. It's one of the conditions that men get in the United States. And in fact, probably 90% of the men in the United States by the age of 80 have it. So, and about 40% require medical treatment. So what do we do about this? Well, you start looking at the balances of testosterone. And unfortunately, and this was published in the Journal of Gerontology and Medical Sciences, a high testosterone is not good. In fact, you don't want a high testosterone. You want a normal amount of free testosterone because that will allow you to maintain muscle mass, strength, endurance, libido, and good emotions. But too much can cause rage. Think of all the people in sports that are on the anabolic steroids. Think of all the police officers. Think of all the people in the military. You're going into an environment where you may have fear. You may want to compete with all the other people who are pumping up and bursting at the seams. And, well, that causes emotional imbalance. That can cause fits of rage. And a lot of people do injury to themselves or other people when they're in these fits of rage. And we never say, gee whiz, let's check their testosterone. We just assume that they're fine. Not true. Now, meat pushes your estrogen levels and testosterone levels up. And so go on a plant-based diet for 30 days. Measure your testosterone, including your free testosterone, before and then afterwards. Measure your estrogen level at the same time. And as your testosterone comes down and your estrogen comes down, watch your moods improve, your sleep improve, and you're also going to have a healthier prostate. And finally, orange juice could help improve brain function in elderly people. This is from the University of Reading in the United Kingdom. And here's what it says. I'll quote, quote, the study saw a group of healthy adults who were averaging 67 years of age consuming just under a pint of orange juice daily over an 8-week period. At the beginning and end of the 8 weeks, their memory, reaction time, and verbal fluency was measured. These were then combined into one overall score known as the global cognitive function. The adults showed an improvement overall in global cognitive function after orange juice consumption compared to the control drink. There was none. So that means that a glass of orange juice helps your brain, helps your cognition, helps mental functioning of the brain. Now, keep in mind that if you have diabetes or pre-diabetic, what you would do is you would still have your orange juice, but you would dilute it in a plant-based protein powder and then triple that amount, you know, like make or do quadruple, like make like 32 ounces, and then drink that a little in the morning, mid-morning, and lunch. And that way you're getting the orange juice, but you're also getting the protein, so your blood sugar is not going to spike. So you have a nice normal blood sugar, and your brain is benefiting. But if you really wanted to benefit, you would combine orange juice with fresh organic grape juice and equal parts, and then dilute that with apple juice or water and have protein in it and put some lemon in it. That helps your brain because of the resveratrol and the proanthocyanidins that are in the grape juice, definitely helping your brain. So your brain is being helped by numerous different inputs, plus your blood sugar is maintained, and you're going more alkaline because of the lemon juice. That's a great combination to have in any case. And it really is very thirst-quenching. What I do is you make orange juice ice cubes, grape juice ice cubes, and lemon ice cubes. And then after a hard workout where you're really sweating and thirsty, you put all that into a blender and blend it up with some water. It's like a cold slushy, but it's got all the nutrients, and it quenches your thirst at the same time. That's our latest on health and nutrition. And we're going to take a break. And when we come back, a commentary, and then from there, our guests. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. I keep watching at times to see how different media handle the social crisis in our society. And it's amazing how they'll use any violence, no matter how few people are engaged in it, as a way of offering in their own social dynamic issues. I'd like to take issue with Bill O'Reilly and the people at Fox, who believe that we are all equal, we're all capable of succeeding. All we need is to get off any form of public assistance and to pull ourselves up by our bootstraps. How many times have we heard that? I don't believe that. The pathology of the rich white family is the most dangerous pathology in America, according to Chris Hedges. And he believes that the rich white family is cursed with, what do we have? Too much money, too much privilege, and devoid of empathy, the result of lifetimes of entitlement. By the way, how many wealthy people do you think there are in the United States today? And I'm not talking about the super wealthy. I'm not talking about those who are billionaires who have hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm talking about millionaires whose net value, excluding their homes, is $1 million. you have between 8 to 10 million millionaires in the United States. And how many people are in the average family? About 4. So at the high end, we could say we have about 40 million people who come from that white, rich family. Now, not all of them are unethical or immoral or insensitive. They're certainly decent, honorable people in all levels. But you have to look at who controls the body politic, the financial institutions, big corporations, the media. Who are the opinion leaders and the policymakers? And then you start to redefine this. And what we see is we see a whole group of people devoid of empathy, the result of this entitlement. And it has little sense of loyalty and lacks the capacity for self-sacrifice. Its definition of friendship is reduced to, what can you do for me? It is possessed by an insatiable lust to create its fortunes and power. It believes that wealth and privilege confer to it a superior intelligence and virtue. It's infused with an unchecked hedonism and narcissism. And because of all this, it interprets reality through the lens of self-adulation and greed that renders it delusional. Think of the selfies. I've never taken a selfie and I won't. I think they're stupid and narcissistic. This whole obsession with trivia and the focus upon oneself and how you feel is if how you feel is the only value there is. The rich white family is a menace. The pathologies of the poor, when set against the pathologies of the rich white people, are like a candle set against the sun. There are no shortages of acolytes and propagandists for rich white families. They dominate our airwaves. They blame poverty, social breakdown, urban violence, drug use, domestic abuse, and crime on the pathology of poor black families. Not that they know any of these people. They argue that poor black families disintegrate because of some inherent defect. Here you can read between the lines that white people are better than black people, a defect that these poor families need to fix. Peddle this simplistic and racist garbage, and you'll be given a column in the New York Times. It always pays to suck up to rich white families. If you're black and parrot the line, rich white people are overcome with joy. They go to extreme lengths to give you a platform. You can become president of a Supreme Court justice. You can get a television talk show or tenure at a university. You can get money from your research projects or for your foundation. You can publish self-help books. Your films will be funded. You might even be hired to run a company. Rich white families, their sycophants, opine, have tried to help. Rich white families have given poor people numerous resources and government programs to lift them out of poverty. They keep using the numbers as if a number alone. We gave so many trillions of dollars to the poor, so why haven't they gotten better? It must be their fault. They don't all have fathers. That's the reason why. No, Mr. O'Reilly, that is not the reason. They have provided generous charity, but blacks, they say, along with other poor people of color, are defeated by self-destructive attitudes and behavior. Government programs are therefore wasted on these irresponsible people. Poor families, the sycophants tell us, will not be redeemed until they redeem themselves. We want to help rich white people, say, but poor black people need to pull themselves up. Stay in school, get an education, find a job. Say no to drugs and respect authority. If they don't, they deserve what they get. And what the average black family ends up with in economic terms is a nickel for every dollar held by the average white family. Starting at age 10 as a scholarship student in an elite university in New England boarding school, Chris Hedges was forced to make a study of the pathology of rich white families. It was not an experience that he recommended. Years later, by choice, He says, quote, I moved to Boston Roxbury neighborhood when I was in a seminary student. I lived across the street from one of the poorest housing projects in the city, and I ran a small church in the inner city for nearly 3 years. I already had a deep distaste for rich white families, and that increased greatly after I saw what they did to the disenfranchised. Rich white people, I concluded after my childhood and Roxbury experiences, are sociopaths. Well, I'm sure some are. I'm sure some are not. The misery and collapse of community and family in Roxbury were not caused by an inherent pathology within the black family. Rich people who treated the poor like human refuge caused the problems. Layers of institutional racism, the court system, the schools, the police, the probation officers, the banks, the easy access to drugs, the endemic unemployment and underemployment, the collapsing infrastructures and the prison system, those, as well as offshoring of the jobs that once gave meaningful employment and a quality of life and a standard of living, those conspired to make sure that the poor remain poor. Drug use, crime, and disintegrating families are the result of poverty, not race. Poor whites, where I come from in West Virginia, they live the same lives, unfortunately, as poor blacks. But unfortunately, it is always the poor black that is shown to be the example of what causes society to deteriorate. Poor whites replicate this behavior, take away opportunity, infuse lives with despair and hopelessness, and this is what you get. But that is something rich white families do not want people to know. If it were known, the rich would have to take the blame. According to the writings of Michael Krauss and Paul Pith and Dasher Keltner, social scientists, University of California, they did the research that led them to conclude that the poor have more empathy than the rich. The poor, they argued, do not have the ability to dominate their environments. They must build relationships with others to survive. This requires that they be able to read the emotions of those around them and respond. It demands they look after each other, and this makes them more empathetic. The rich who can control their environments do not need to bother with the concerns or emotions of others. They are in charge. What they want done gets done. And the longer they live at the center of their own universe, the more callous and sensitive and cruel they become. The rich white family has an unrivaled aptitude for crime. Members of the rich white families run corporations into the ground, think Lehman Brothers. They defraud stockholders and investors. They sell toxic mortgages as gold-plated investments to pension funds and communities and schools, and then loot the U.S. Treasury when the whole thing implodes. They steal hundreds of millions of dollars on Wall Street through fraud and theft, pay little or no taxes, almost never go to jail. They write laws and regulations that legalize their crimes, and then are asked to become trustees at elite universities and sit on corporate boards. They set up foundations and are admired as philanthropic individuals. And if they get into legal trouble, they have high-priced lawyers and connections among the political elite to get them out. You have to hand it to the rich white families. They steal with greater finesse than anyone else. If you're a poor black teenager and sprint out of a CVS store with a few looted bottles of shampoo, you're likely to be shot in the back or sent to jail for years. If there were an Olympiad for crime, rich white families would sweep up all the medals. Blacks would be lucky to come within a mile of the first elimination trial. I don't know why black people even try to compete in this area. They are, by comparison, utter failures as criminals. The monarchs of crime are rich white people who wallow in their pilfered wealth while locking away in prisons a huge percentage of poor men of color. Rich white families are also the most efficient killers on the planet. This has been true for five centuries, starting with the conquest of the Americas and the genocide against Native Americans, and continuing through today's wars in the Middle East. Rich white families themselves don't actually kill. They are not about to risk their necks on streets or in Iraq, for example. They hire people, often poor, to kill for them. Rich white families wanted the petroleum of Iraq, and by waving the flag and spewing patriotic slogans, got a lot of poor kids to join the military and take the oil fields for them. Rich white people wanted endless war for the benefit of their arms industry, and they got it by calling for a war on terror. Rich white people wanted police to use lethal force against the poor with impunity and to arrest them, swelling U.S. prisons with 25% of the world's prison population, so they set up a system of drug laws and militarized police departments to make it happen. The beauty of making others kill on your behalf is that you get to appear reasonable and nice. You get to chastise poor people and Muslims for being angry fanatics. You get to spread the message of tolerance with a cherubic smile, which means tolerating the crimes and violence of rich white people. Compare a drive-by shooting in Watts with the saturation bombing of Vietnam. Compare a gangland killing in Chicago with militarized police shooting a person of black almost every day. No one else knows how to churn out corpses like rich white people. 1 million dead alone in Iraq, and the rich and powerful kill staggering numbers of people and never go to prison. They can retire in a ranch in Crawford, Texas, and paint amateurish portraits of world leaders copied by Google image search. There's no decadency like the decadency of rich white people. I knew a billionaire who in retirement spent his time on a yacht smoking weed and being catered to by a string of high-priced prostitutes. The children of rich white families surrounded by servants and coddled in private schools, never having to fly on commercial airplanes or take public transportation, develop a lassitude, sometimes accompanied by a drug habit, that often leads them to idle away their lives as social parasites. Mothers never have to be mothers. Fathers never have to be fathers. The help does the parenting. The rich live encased in little kingdoms, one guarded by their own private security, where the real world does not intrude. They are cultural Philistines, preoccupied with acquiring more wealth and possessions. Material possess, says C. Wright Mills, is their sole basis of authority. Yeah, they meld into the world of celebrity, and the organs of mass media which they control turn them into idols to be worshipped solely because they're rich. Public relations specialists manufacture the public personas. Teams of lawyers harass and silence their critics. Acolytes affirm their significance. And one day they wake up, and foolish them, they actually believe their own fiction. The rich executed a coup d'etat that transformed the three branches of the U.S. government and nearly all institutions, including the mass media, into a wholly owned subsidiary of all the corporate state. This coup gives the rich the license and the power to amass unimaginable wealth at our expense. It permits the rich to inflict grinding poverty on growing circles of the population. Poverty is the worst of crimes. As George Bernard Shaw wrote, all the other crimes are virtues beside it. And the ability of the rapacious power elite to let children go hungry, to let men and women suffer a loss of dignity and self-worth because there are no jobs, to abandon cities to decay and squalor, to toss the mentally ill and the homeless onto the streets, to slash the meager services that give them some hope and succor to those who suffer, to lock hundreds of thousands of poor people in cages for years, to wage endless war, to burden students with crushing debt, to unleash state terror, and to extinguish hope among the least fortunate exposes our wealthy oligarchs as the most dangerous and destructive force in America. Chris Hedges. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. I'm Gary Nall, and I want to let you know that we have, thus far this year, over 100 million visits, people downloading articles, sharing information on the important issues like vaccines, and genetically engineered materials. So we're providing documentaries, articles. All of our articles that we do are fully scientifically referenced and vetted for accuracy. So go to prn.fm or progressiveradionetwork.com, and just each day, hundreds of articles that are important from all over the world. Now we're going to talk about something that rarely gets any discussion and certainly no debate, and that is the subject of AIDS. And my guest from Calgary, Canada, is David Crowe. David is the president of the Alberta Reappraising AIDS and Rethinking AIDS, whose website he hosts at the rethinkingaids.com. It's a science news resource on all the international research and community that challenges the current HIV/AIDS model. He's also former president treasurer of the Green Party in Alberta, Canada, and he hosts a show called The Infectious Myth on the Progressive Radio Network every Tuesday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Nice to have you with us today, David.
I'm pleased to be with you again, Gary.
David, one of the reasons I wanted you on is I wanted to offer the people in this audience an opportunity to see why there are controversies, why there are disagreements on the war on AIDS. And on the one hand, those of us who have done our homework, spent tens of thousands of hours, which I have, investigating the different aspects of the AIDS issue. And AIDS is not a single disease. It is a syndrome. It is multiple conditions, over 30 different conditions, that we have collectively called AIDS. So it's not one thing we're talking about. And at the very beginning of this, I'd already been working in the field for 10 years before 1984, when at a press conference at a French restaurant in Bethesda, Maryland, Margaret Heckler, who was the head of our Health and Human Resources, said that the probable cause of AIDS had been discovered, and Robert Gallo then gave his insight that it was this HIV virus. I supported ACT UP. I had them on my program. I supported the effort to make sure that that people who had any AIDS-defining illness were helped. And in fact, I set up a whole program, which later would find that at least 1,200 people personally, by my efforts, were helped at no charge, and many of those people had their AIDS-defining illnesses reversed. I wrote about 24 articles on AIDS. I wrote a textbook on AIDS that was edited by Professor Jim Feast, and he was selected by the Seven Stories Press publisher that is probably the primary liberal publishing house in the United States, small publishing house, because he wanted to make sure every fact was correct. And we have over 3,900 resource references in there, and we haven't had to change anything, nor in any of the articles, nor in five multi-award-winning documentaries. In spite of all that, including article after article on how AIDS-defining illnesses can be helped prolong a person's life, even save their life, using natural non-toxic therapies, I and many others were challenged as being AIDS denialers because we didn't buy the one philosophy that everyone had to get in line with. That was that there's only one way of looking at AIDS, and if you challenge that, if you challenge our authority, if you challenge our power, if you challenge what we're doing, we're going to destroy your reputations. And as a result of that, they spread lies, and now it's very clear, they've been doing this for a long time, now it's very clear they're trying to destroy the reputations of anyone who challenges the vaccines or GMOs. They're going after Jeffrey Smith, they're going after parents. There's massive campaigns, but now that's come to light. Now the curtain's been pulled back, and you see these AstroTurfs, you see these groups who are financed by Big Pharma, who are using friendly names that are pro-environment names, but are really industries are behind these. They're looking to identify anyone who challenges the existing power structure and destroy them. But back then, we didn't know all this. We knew that they would not come out and debate. And we would say, we believe that AIDS exists, we're fighting it, we're helping, but we're doing it in a natural way, with natural protocols, and we're getting good results. Come and look at the results. They had never come. Holding a press conference, come and see 100 different doctors and their patients using natural protocols, and these are long-lived, healthy survivors, but they're not using your drugs. No one would come. So they wouldn't debate, they wouldn't come, they wouldn't share the information, and yet the media only reported on them. So take us through now, challenging the existing myths, as you have done more than, I'll bet, anyone else, including your efforts to debate these people. And I want to put this out right now. I'm inviting any member of ACT UP or anyone else who is pro the AIDS Orthodox Protocol to come on this program and to have an honest, open debate with myself, David Crow. We have several Nobel Prize winners, Carrie Mullis. Come and debate these people. But they won't
do
it.
I would love to see that. One of the people that I recently tried to not debate, but to interview on my PRN show, The Infectious Myth, is a man named Seth Kalickman, who sort of became infamous a few years ago when he took a false name and went underground to infiltrate the dissident movement, which is kind of bizarre because we're a very open movement. It wasn't necessary at all. But when we looked up his grants over the past 22 years, he's averaged about $1.6 million a year in grants from the National Institutes of Health alone, and he may well have got other money from other places. That doesn't go into his pocket directly, but it makes him a very valuable member of the University of Connecticut because a portion of those funds go to the university. It certainly helps him develop a bigger lab with more grad students, and you know, that money can be used for travel and other things like that. So there's a huge amount of money, and I wanted to talk to Seth Kalickman about his views on AIDS, and he basically just wrote me back an email saying that that I was a danger to public health, and he wasn't going to talk to me. And that's normally what we get. I feel very powerful because I'm apparently, and not just me, but people like Peter Duesberg, we're too dangerous to talk to, because if people listen to us, they might actually believe what we say. And I think that's because some of the things we say makes sense. You know, like, for example, we're very knowledgeable about the Nancy Padian study that was published in 1997 that followed couples, of which one was HIV positive, one HIV negative, followed them for 10 years in an individual couple up to 6 years, and they found zero cases where the HIV negative couple, HIV negative partner became positive. That's the best American study on sexual transmission of HIV, and it found zero transmission. And so it's just ignored, even though there's nothing better. There was a study in South Africa that found that among young black women, 23% were HIV positive, but among young black men, only 6.4%. Yet, as is true all around the world, the men were more promiscuous than the women. So these statistics just don't add up, and so therefore they're ignored, and people go back to the mantra, AIDS is a sexually transmitted disease, and you need to wear a condom and all this kind of stuff, even though there's really no scientific evidence for that.
All right, let's also look at I think the biggest challenge for the AIDS establishment came when we began to look at AZT. I was approached by one of the people who were overseeing the FDA's fast-track trials at Rochester University, and she gave me all this data showing that if you died, you were excluded. Well, that immediately nullifies the entire value of the study. If someone dies while they're taking AZT and you don't count that, then it's a fraudulent study. She had reams of documents plus letters she had sent to the FDA, and they were not going to change. Then she also told me that the sugar tablet, the placebo, was made of lactose, and therefore when you tasted it, it was sweet, so people were getting together, opening up their capsules. If the capsule was bitter, it was AZT, and they would keep it and use it, and if it was sweet, it was a placebo. Nobody wanted the placebo. They all wanted to believe that AZT would help them. So in effect, one group of people were all taking AZT, and nobody was taking a placebo. She explained that to me. And
yeah.
And so when the study was flawed, then I started seeing people who one of their partners was working within our program at the Tri-State Healing Center, but the other partner didn't believe in the natural approach and was taking AZT, and without exception, every one of them taking these high milligrams, upwards of 1,500 milligrams of AZT a day, were dying, and they were dying fast. Could you share with us and everything you say today, I want you to show with peer review in the literature, actual citations, how AZT was killing people at a very high level.
Well, I mean, start with the chemistry. For anybody who's done high school biology, you know that DNA is made up of four bases, ACGT, adenosine, cytosine, thymine, thymidine, guanine. AZT, the T in AZT stands for thymidine. It's a false analog for one of the DNA bases. So what that means is while the chain of DNA is being built in your body, one molecule of AZT will stop one chain of DNA from dividing. So you would expect a drug like what's called a nucleoside analog, you would expect a drug like that to damage the blood supply, because when the blood cells try to divide, one molecule of AZT will stop one blood cell from dividing, which means it's going to be difficult for your body to produce new blood cells, which have to be replenished on a regular basis. And in fact, one of the major side effects of AZT is anemia, of all types of anemia, like anemia of red blood cells and of white blood cells. White blood cells, of course, are a major component of the immune system. So AZT directly damages the immune system. So just from the basic chemistry, well, one can understand that AZT will cause immune deficiency, and it will cause many of the symptoms of AIDS. And if you read the GlaxoSmithKline monograph, the document describing AZT, it uses a few weasel words, but it essentially says the side effects of this drug are difficult to distinguish from the progression of the disease. In other words, this drug can produce the same symptoms as the disease is supposed to be preventing. But there was, I think, in those days, there was a lot of terror, and people had accepted the death pronouncement that their doctor had given them, and they were desperate to take anything. And there was only one drug available between 1987 and 1991 when DDI came out, which was just as toxic. So in those years, AZT was the only game in town. And throughout those years, from 1987 to 1991, the death rate went up linearly in the United States. Every year, there were more deaths throughout the entire period of time in which AZT was the only drug available. And it wasn't until 1995 when the dosage of AZT had been dramatically reduced and newer, less toxic drugs, I don't think they were healthy drugs, the protease inhibitors, when less toxic drugs came out, the death rate started to plummet, although it's still above 10,000 people a year in the United States.
All right, let's look at one of the groups that have been the loudest critics of anyone who challenges anything, no matter what your background or credentials, no matter how much truth or proof you have, they simply will not accept it, and that is ACT UP. Because I remember when ACT UP had one voice, and a reasonable voice, and a good mission, and then I remember when it split in two, and then you have one voice that was willing and actually wanting to promote a more natural approach, and another voice that wanted to align itself with the pharmaceutical approach. Tell us about that.
I interviewed a man named Jim Farratt, who was a gay man in New York City. He's lived there since the time of AIDS up to the present day. And when I interviewed him, he described, this has been described by many other people, gay men started to see this plague amongst themselves, and they started to band together to try to solve it. And there were many approaches. People clamoring for new drugs, people looking at alternative remedies, people looking at lifestyle factors like, for example, the use of the inhalant recreational drugs, poppers, which were used by all six of the original AIDS cases that were documented in 1981. And he showed how some people in ACT UP who were more pushing the pharmaceutical approach started to get funding from the drug companies. That group became more powerful. They had money, and gradually, the group of people who wanted other approaches fell apart. And so ACT UP became purely a pusher of pharmaceutical drugs. Same thing happened in South Africa, where there was this organization called the Treatment Action Campaign, which was very strongly pushing antiretroviral drugs as the only solution for AIDS in South Africa, riding roughshod over the concerns of people like the President Thabo Mbeki that drugs like AZT were highly toxic.
Okay. Now, what about the money? Where does the money in the world on AIDS go? Because there's been a tremendous amount of money made off the AIDS drug, and you got to follow the money trail if you want to see who the critics are and why they're adamant not to allow natural, non-toxic treatments that would keep people alive and living healthy, normal lives,
well,
instead lining people up to take their drugs.
Right. I think you need to ask where the money comes from first. And in the United States, every year, the U.S. government adds about $1 billion to the budget. So by that, I don't mean that they spend $1 billion each year. That means if the budget last year was $29 billion, this year it's $30 billion. And they've been doing that since the 1980s. So the budget now is about $30 billion this year just for U.S. government funding for AIDS. That doesn't count money that's spent by drug companies, money that's spent by other governments. So I don't know the exact total, but I know it's a lot more than $30 billion. And that money flows through the drug companies for trials, through universities, through organizations like ACT UP. There's just a wash of money and really hardly any patients. Like in Canada, in 2013, there were 31 deaths from AIDS. And yet every town in Canada has an AIDS service organization, which at present must be fighting over, tiny number of new AIDS cases that are found. And even in America, as the number of cases has dropped and the number of deaths has dropped, the amount of funding each year has just gone up and up, putting it way out of line with any other organization. It's a great lifestyle for people and totally corrupts the entire system because most people at the top are in it solely for the money.
Okay, well, I don't know who's in it for the money and who's not. I can't make that statement. All I know is that if they approached AIDS differently, they could save a lot of money and save a lot more lives. Let me give you the best example. The man who won the Nobel Prize for discovering HIV also had this to say. We're going to play you a short clip of how he believed that the best approach for AIDS was. Listen carefully what he has to say, and how no one in the mainstream media is covering this, and no one in our government or these scientific organizations are researching this, and the doctors are not applying this. And yet he's the one who is the most important single person in the entire war on AIDS.
You talked about oxidative stress earlier. Is treating oxidative stress one of the best ways to deal with the African AIDS epidemic?
I think this is one way to approach, to decrease the rate of transmission, because I believe HIV, we can be exposed to HIV many times without being chronically infected. Our immune system could get rid of the virus within a few weeks if you have a good immune system. And this is a problem also of African people. Their nutrition is not very equilibrated. They are in oxidative stress, even they are not infected with HIV. So their immune system doesn't work well already. So it's prone, they can, allow HIV to get in and persist. So there are many ways which are not the vaccine, the magic name, the vaccine. Many ways to decrease the transmission just by simple measures of nutrition, giving antioxidants, proper antioxidants, hygiene measures, fighting the other infections. So they are not spectacular, but they could, decrease very well the epidemic to the level they are in occidental countries,
so
Western countries.
If you have a good immune system, then your body can naturally get rid of HIV.
Yes.
Oh, interesting. Do you think we should have more of a push for antioxidants and things of that nature in Africa than antiretrovirals?
We should push for more, a combination of measures, antioxidant, but nutrition, advice and nutrition. Fighting other infections, malaria, tuberculosis, parasitosis. Most children have worms. education, of course, genital hygiene for women and men also. Very simple measure, which is not very expensive, but which could do a lot. And this is my worry about, the many spectacular actions. Of course, there are global funds to buy drugs and so on, Bill Gates and so on, for the vaccine. But, those kind of measures are not very well funded, not funded at all, or they are, you know, it really depends on the local government to take conscious of this, but local government, they take advice of the scientific advisors from the international institutions, and they don't get this kind of advice very often.
There's no money in nutrition, right? There's no profit.
There's no profit, yes. The water is important. Water is key.
Now, one thing you said, you were talking about the fact that if you have a built immune system, it is possible to get rid of HIV naturally. If you take a poor African who's been infected and you build up their immune system, is it possible for them to also naturally get rid of it?
I would think so.
Okay. That's an important point.
It's important knowledge which is completely neglected. You know, people always think...
Okay, here's what you just heard the most important person in the entire world of AIDS say. Yes, you can get rid of the HIV virus with antioxidants, good nutrition, and proper hygiene and clean water. Yes, you could get rid of it in Africans if you did the same. And no, there's no money in it, and it's not being funded, and that they're trying to put all their energy into a vaccine. So that's important to understand, that what he is telling is what we've been doing for 35 years, and yet the AIDS establishment, the ones who call those of us who are helping people who have AIDS-defining illnesses live a longer and healthier life, they're not recognizing what the top person who won the Nobel Prize is saying. So doesn't that show you, David, some of the hypocrisy, this whole, you know, all of these people in this disinformation campaign?
Yes, Luc Montagnier won the Nobel Prize in 2008 jointly with Francoise Barry-Sinoussi for the supposed discovery of HIV, and it kind of illustrates a real problem with the pharmaceutically oriented medicine, especially in North America and Europe, and that is the desire of the ordinary person for a quick fix to a problem. That's almost universal, and the desire of the allopathic medical community to provide that for a fee, which in the case of AIDS is about $20,000 a year just in the drugs alone. And so gay men in the early 1980s really had a choice. They could say there are aspects of our lifestyle, like some of us are using a lot of drugs, especially inhalant poppers, and we really need to work on that. And some people like John Lauritsen and Hank Wilson did that. And other people said, it's our sexuality that's the problem. We're having too much sex, and we need a pill to fix it. And so they got AZT, and the death rate just kept going up and up. And relatively few people wanted to go the other route because that meant that their lifestyle had to change. They had to stop using drugs. They had to focus on a better diet. They had to make sure that they got fresh air and exercise in their daily routine. Those are lifestyle factors, and we can look at the average American, forget about AIDS for a moment, you see huge problems with obesity, which causes diabetes and heart disease. People do not want to reform their diet. People do not want to take exercise. They would rather go to the doctor and get a pill for cholesterol or high blood pressure or whatever it is than reform their life, which is what is necessary to live a healthy life no matter what kind of lifestyle you have.
Well, David, I appreciate you coming on to offer this insight. And if people want to hear from the 3,000 scientists, journalists, activists, including multiple Nobel Prize winners and professors of biology, who are asking for an open debate so that we can really help the people with AIDS-defining illnesses and not based upon a pharmaceutical model, they can go to your website, rethinkingaids.com.
That's correct.
And or listening to your program, The Infectious Myth, every Tuesday Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network. Thank you very much, David.
Thanks for having me on, Gary. Bye-bye.
Bye. And we're out of time, everyone. Thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more tomorrow. Have a nice day.
Your past.